From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Tragedy sometimes provides inspiration. A new play in Atlanta is based on a horrible attack here in the past, and a disease has inspired new artwork. All that is coming up, but first let's revisit a conversation we had yesterday about a dispute between Georgia and Florida. Florida sued our state over excessive water use, and I talked about this with E&E news reporter Amanda Riley.
The Supreme Court is getting a growing number of these interstate water disputes, but it's actually really rare for the Supreme Court to go through this process of divvying up water to the parties that are involved. I think the last time that actually happened in the East Coast was in the 1930s.
We heard from you here your first thoughts. Mercer University Law Professor Dave Odell emailed us. He says, often the most efficient solution to a knotty legal case can be found by watching which party's willing to fight the longest and hardest and which gives up. David adds, quote, a general's way of thinking about this insight is that sometimes wars are won and lost by attrition, not flashy battles, end quote. We love getting your thoughts. You can call us at 404-500-9457, tweet us at OST Talk, or email us like David did, and we might feature your comments on the show. Atlanta has the fifth highest rate of new HIV diagnoses, but recent CDC data shows annual infections have dropped by around 18% nationwide, and by about 6% in Georgia. Here to talk about this is Tiffany Roan. She's the Georgia Regional Director for the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. It's good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
First, can we establish why Georgia and Atlanta especially has higher rates than most of the nation?
Well, there are several reasons why we have higher rates. But, you know, here in Georgia, we are fifth in the nation. And as a city, the city of Atlanta actually ranks fifth amongst metropolitan areas. And a lot of it has to do with, of course, socioeconomic status, access to medications, access to care. We also have to talk about our MSM population as well. And that's where we see our staggering rates and disparities.
This is something actually that Matt Terrell talks about. He's a freelance journalist in Atlanta. He installed the pyramid-shaped marker outside the Center for Civil and Human Rights. That artwork I was speaking of, it is updated weekly with figures on the number of people in Atlanta with HIV. And here is Terrell.
HIV is a human rights issue. Lack of respect for human rights, such as access to education, in particular sex education, lack of access to health care. When you don't respect these human rights issues, HIV actually is exacerbated and grows in communities.
So that leads me to the question on how we've started to bring the rates down. Are we addressing some of these things that Matt's talking about?
Well, really, the rates are coming down due to some of the preventative measures that have been made available. Now, I will say that we still have a long ways to go whenever we're talking about access, particularly in the state of Georgia, where things like Medicaid expansion did not take place. Most of the care that we provide for individuals who aren't able to have insurance or afford insurance on their own that are HIV positive is through our Y and White federal program. That is a program that Georgia has received increased funding for throughout the most recent years, which I think has contributed to some of those reductions. But we're still having a lot of disparities, particularly amongst African-American population. And that's, again, not just going back to access to the Ryan White program, but there's so many caveats there. We have a lot of individuals who still fall in the gap, and there are limitations to what can be provided, even with those funds available. And without Medicaid expansion, you still have hundreds of thousands of individuals in Georgia who do not have the appropriate access, even if they are able and willing to get tested. What do we do with them then if we don't have funding and access for them?
Now, one of our producers spoke a couple years ago with a young man named Lamar Yarbrough. He is both HIV positive and has AIDS, and he talked a little bit about this racial disparity. He feels that there's actually not enough people in the Black community speaking up about this.
You don't have a lot of people who are advocates, who are African-American men that I've seen, you know, growing up. We are dying from this. And so, therefore, it makes me step up to the plate and say I need to be a leader and to educate my fellow people of color so that for we don't die from this epidemic.
How much does it matter who's the advocate and what they look like and what community they belong to?
Oh, it matters a great deal. It matters a great deal because especially when you're talking about the African-American population, there are a lot of cultural a lot of cultural stigma. And, you know, one of the things that we have to be able to do in the African-American community is understand that this is not a special population issue. This is a community-wide issue. It's not an issue of the gay community. It's not an issue of drug users. This is something that's ravaging the entire African-American community. So to take the stigma away.
Okay, since we're speaking about stigma, you know, when HIV/AIDS first sort of burst onto the American scene, at least, a lot of people didn't want to talk about it because it is an STD. They didn't want to talk about it because, in many ways, unfairly, it was associated with the gay community. And let's go back to Matt Terrell, freelance journalist in Atlanta, who designed the artwork that's outside the Center for Civil and Human Rights right now. He says that he feels... It sounds like what he's saying is that he feels HIV and AIDS are just not being spoken enough about.
You know, when you look around, there are lots of people, politicians, healthcare professionals, doctors, lawyers, business people, people who may think that they are not at risk for HIV. They may never know somebody who is HIV positive. I want to communicate to these people that HIV is still a problem and that we all live with HIV.
To what extent do you think HIV and AIDS have sort of fallen out of common discussion?
Oh, it's absolutely fallen out of common discussion. And one of the hardest things that we face is balancing giving hope to those who are living with HIV to know that there are great medications and interventions out there, but at the same time, not normalizing it to where particularly our millennials and our younger generation don't take it seriously. And unfortunately, we see in our AIDS service organizations right now here in Georgia, particularly our millennials coming in, not just one at a time getting tested, but coming in groups getting tested. And, you know, it's very heartbreaking because I've even had an 18-year-old individual come in for testing and with another friend. And I was just kind of talking with them. And his exact words to me were, you know, I know tons of people who have HIV. It's not a big deal. You know, you have medications you take every day. And he actually said to me, it's like taking a vitamin every day.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Tiffany Roan. She's the Georgia Regional Director for the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. And yet, Tiffany, what we're talking about here is at least, especially nationwide, a massive drop in the number of new infections for HIV. So something's working. What do you think has been the most effective part?
I think the most effective part has been the medications. And the reason I say that is because we know that if people who do know that they're positive and they're in care and they're on medications and they're healthier, they're virally suppressed. And we do know that the more virally suppressed a person is, the lower their rate of transmission is to others. And so, you know, it's taken a while, but it's a term called prevention or treatment is prevention. I think that has a great deal to do with it. Of course, you know, we have things like PrEP, which are positive interventions that could be used in particular situations, specific situations. But keeping those viral loads, because if you stated earlier that the rates of AIDS has definitely decreased and the rates of deaths because of AIDS has decreased, but you're still looking at a high number of individuals who are living with HIV. I mean, in Georgia alone, we have 53,000 Georgians who are HIV positive. And if you want to drill down, the city of Atlanta, over almost 32,000 of them are right here in the city of Atlanta. And if those numbers persist, you're looking at one in every 51 Georgians being diagnosed with HIV in their lifetime. So although we do have some positive interventions that are helping, we still cannot get comfortable with the numbers.
What are you worried about in the future? These are positive numbers. I know you said not to get comfortable. Mm-hmm. I'm not comfortable, but they're still going in the right direction. But what concerns you, especially as the Congress starts debating whether to repeal the ACA or not, which might limit even further access to healthcare? How worried are you about something like that?
That is the biggest worry of the HIV community and the medical community as a whole, because, again, treatment is what has really helped reduce the community viral load. And if we have individuals who don't have access to providers, healthcare providers, and access to the medications that are needed, we will see transmission rates increase. And so that is probably my biggest concern. Something else that we do also need to pay attention to in that same data, they talked about injection drug usage and how there has been a decrease in HIV rates with injection drug users. again, can't get comfortable with that, because although that is true and that is positive, we are in the midst of an opioid addiction increase in the country and within the state of Georgia as well. And so with that increase in opiate usage, we're now going to see injection drug increase, which then we'll see HIV increase. So we need to continue to advocate with our local and state legislators on harm reduction programs like clean needle exchanges so that we can keep those numbers at that reduced rate.
So then let's talk about one more thing, and I want to go back to Lamar Yarbrough, who is HIV positive and also has AIDS. And he's talking specifically about why this is a special problem in the South.
Pretty much within the South, we do an abstinence-only teaching. And if you were to catch an STD, I remember the video. I mean, it was like, you know, the steam rising. You had to be in a dark alley, you know, the girls with the short skirts on, guys with the sagging pants. And I remember, like, you know, friends and I, we kind of checked out because, like, that's not us. You know, we talk proper, you know. I mean, we do what we're supposed to do. It just didn't apply to us.
So what kind of changes have we seen in education? You're shaking your head already. We haven't.
The education system is a very difficult system to intersect whenever you're trying to do anything with sexual health. You know, we've talked about HIV rates, but let's not forget Georgia also ranks top 3 to 5 for every STD in the nation. And that is a sign and a symptom of where our HIV rates are going.
Wow, wait a second. I want to go back to that statistic.
Yes.
Georgia rates between either the top 3 or 5 in the nation for every single STD?
Gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis. We had a massive syphilis outbreak in Georgia just a few years ago. So it's not just about HIV. We're talking about STDs in general, and that goes back to education. You know, one of the problems that we have in updating the education as provided to our youth is school boards. You know, each individual municipality gets to decide what they want to allow. So it's not a federal mandate that can be slapped down and says, we change, you know, sex education in schools. Each individual municipality gets to decide what they allow in. And unfortunately, HIV education is not a big one. We have a lot of outside organizations who typically try to get that education to the youth through after-school programs and outside programs. But getting it into the schools, we have just not been extremely successful overall within the state of Georgia of making that happen.
So we have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to go back to this artwork that is now standing outside the Center for Civil and Human Rights. It looks like a little pyramid, and
yes,
it keeps a running tally of people who new infections of,
yes,
HIV. Why does it belong outside the Center for Civil and Human Rights? If we're talking about a healthcare issue, why is it there?
Just as the clip that you played from Matt Terrell, the artist earlier, HIV is a civil and human rights issue because, again, we're going back to the right to have access to health care. We're talking about stigma, and we're talking about discrimination against different classes of individuals because they are stigmatized, as we spoke earlier, with the idea of HIV. So it's very much a civil rights issue. And when you look at what is connected to HIV, it is not just homosexuality. It's poverty. It's lack of education. It's, you know, socioeconomic status, and all of those are civil rights issues. So it very much belongs in outside of the right of the Civil and Human Rights Museum. And actually, I love where it's placed because it's right in between the Civil Rights Museum and the Atlanta Mission.
Yeah.
And the two are so linked because you have individuals there who are impoverished, who are homeless, who are drug users. And
right,
all of those things are what lead to HIV cases.
That is Tiffany Roan. She's the Georgia Regional Director for the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. Tiffany, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
It's on license plates, billboards, movies, even the voting stickers we get. When you think of Georgia, it is not all that uncommon to think of the peach. But peaches are actually pretty rare in Georgia, and they're not native. A new book by Tom Oakey is called The Georgia Peach, Culture, Agriculture, and Environment in the American South. Tom's an assistant professor of history education at Kennesaw State University and joins me now. Hi there.
Thanks for having me.
So when did the Georgia peach become the Georgia peach? When did we first get the peach?
As I say in the book, peaches have always been, well, not always. They've been here since the 16th century, probably. But probably in the late 19th century is when you first hear people talking about the Georgia peach in a kind of iconic way.
Why? Was there something that triggered that?
Yeah, well, there were a group of people called horticulturists who bred lots of different varieties of peaches and lots of other fruit. They hoped to establish a real diverse agriculture in the South. That started in the mid-19th century. By the late 19th century, they had a commercial variety called the Alberta peach, bred by Samuel Rumpf, that was very shippable. And that was the first peach in New York City in June instead of late in the summer. And I think that kind of first peach experience was really important.
So maybe that it became associated with Georgia, even if it wasn't the most common fruit here.
Right. Yeah. I mean, peaches are easy to grow. They grow all over the place.
Yeah.
And Georgia, because of its location, was able to have the first one on the big northern markets.
One of the things is also how easy it was for us in particular to ship. We're right near the water. We were right near train lines.
Sure.
And the peaches may be easy to grow, but they're really hard to ship because they bruise.
They're very tender
fruit. They're so fragile.
They're very fragile.
So that may have helped us. We could just pack them onto boats.
Yeah, that's the other thing about the late 19th century. That's when we finally had refrigerated railroad cars. You did pack them onto boats before that, but that's still a little bit slow for peaches. So once you have a refrigerated railroad car and you can get it to the New York market, say, in a day or two, then you have a money-making product.
Now, when we're talking about the late 19th century, we're talking about the era of the Civil War and Reconstruction. How did the peach economy survive the burning of fields and the cotton both rise and collapse?
Well, one of the interesting things about the rise of the peach is that it actually depended on that destruction of the cotton industry and of slavery. Peach growers, these horticulturists themselves, understood it as emancipation as kind of the opportunity, because all of a sudden you don't have enslaved labor, you have free labor, people who are wandering around, who are willing to work for a short period of time and then leave. And that's exactly what a perishable crop grower needs, right?
Right, yeah. But we've talked before in the show how the peaches are not the most lucrative fruit, even, or the most common fruit in Georgia. I think right now it's still the blueberry. So why are we the peach state? What is it that we like about peaches that we want it to be our symbol?
I think it has a lot to do with timing. I mean, that moment, that late 19th century moment, early 20th century moment, when we still grew way more cotton than peaches.
Yeah.
That's still the same today. But at that moment, you needed, Southerners felt like they needed a new reputation, right? A crop that was not associated with slavery and poverty and environmental degradation, and peaches provided all of that.
Wait, the peach is all about rebranding?
Yeah, you could put it that way. It's a rebranding of the South in the late 19th century, new face.
Do you imagine that's going to persist? I mean, do we keep the peach, or at some point do we become the blueberry state?
You know, that I'm a historian, so I'm not going to make a prediction about the future. But I do think that peaches are gonna persist. The people who grow them now are all family growers who've been doing it for a long time.
Do you eat peaches?
I do.
Do you eat a lot of peaches?
As many as I can.
Tom Oakey is an assistant professor of history education at Kennesaw State University. His new book is called The Georgia Peach, Culture, Agriculture, and Environment in the American South. Tom, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
On October 12th in 1958, it was a quiet Sunday morning, suddenly rocked by an explosion. The temple, which was Georgia's largest synagogue at the time, was bombed. Then Atlanta Mayor William B. Hartsfield condemned the violence.
Atlanta has always been a lighthouse of racial and religious tolerance in the South. And we are shocked and amazed that this awful thing could happen in our midst.
Thankfully, nobody was hurt in that attack, but the community was shaken, and a new play at the Alliance Theater recalls that attack. Jimmy Mays is playwright and director of The Temple Bombing, and he joins me in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
That's kind of an important, and I actually want to, the point that Hartsfield made there of condemning the violence was a moment, and it appears to be that's not just a moment for your play, but for the book on which the play is based, which was written by author and historian Melissa Faye Green, and she talks about, well, I guess the questions that were left in the minds of the Jewish community here.
There was this terrifying moment for the Jewish community about whether the attack would be denounced by the city's white Christian elite. It was instantly denounced by the African American elite, who was experiencing similar attacks all across the country. But would the power structure of white Atlanta take notice?
That clip comes courtesy of the Alliance Theater and Emory University. Why was there so much tension about whether or not the white Christian, especially business leaders and political leaders, would condemn the violence?
Well, like you said, it was a pivotal thing to have the mayor speak at that moment, because up until that moment, there'd really been a vacuum of leadership, not just in Atlanta, but really all across the South in response to bombings and threats against the African-American community as well as the Jewish community. And Atlanta, holding itself up as the city too busy to hate at the time, had been spared, for lack of a better word. It was considered, you know, this liberal bastion of Georgia. So as soon as it happened in Atlanta, there was a question about how the leadership would respond. And the mayor rerouted his driver to the temple that morning and spoke impromptu. That clip that you have, which is also a clip in our play, spoken by an actor, but it is text in our play. And that really was the turning point where, you know, white Christian moderates, as well as moderates across the South, heard strong leadership and changed a tide of what could have been an answer with recrimination or denial at the very worst.
Yeah, just ignoring it. Let's go back for people who've never heard about this particular attack. Let's again listen to historian Melissa J. Green, who wrote this, the book that inspired this play. Here she is talking about that morning.
October 12th, 1958. 50 sticks of dynamite in the middle of the night blew apart the sidewall of the temple, Atlanta's oldest and richest synagogue, which stood in pillared, domed majesty on a grassy hill above Peachtree Street.
What happened? Do we know why the synagogue was bombed, and did they catch the perpetrator?
It seems to be very clear why the synagogue was bombed. The rabbi at the time, Jacob Rothschild, was a vocal advocate for civil rights and speaking in the wake, well, he was speaking since 1946, since he took the pulpit, about civil rights, equal rights. But as soon as Brown versus the Board of Education and you know, things in 1954 really started to heat up, he became a target. I mean, he was receiving letters, he was receiving hate speech, he was had an actual encounter with one of the lead defendant, perpetrator, alleged perpetrator. And so it seems very clear as to why that their synagogue was targeted.
And it was often Jewish lawyers who stood up to defend defend defendants, protesters during the civil rights movement. They were a pretty crucial part of that movement. Mm-hmm. Is that why you say that people were afraid there would be a wider, that this bombing might spread because of that association between the civil rights movement and the Jewish community?
Well, I think the fear, at least as portrayed in my play, which is, you know, a very small slice of
right.
Melissa Faye Green's, you know, wonderful book, the fear, I'm focusing on the congregation itself in terms of their fears and of after effects of the bomb. And really it was that they had already been in a position where blending in with the woodwork was of utmost importance, tracing all the way back to the beginning of their congregation, including the Leo Frank lynching, which in 1915, as many people know, Leo Frank was a member of the same congregation. So since then, and with the previous rabbi, this congregation had not only experienced extreme trauma, but had then been afraid of really celebrating their Jewish heritage, of being visibly Jewish in the community. And so the fear in the wake of the bombing is not just of a repeat of past history in terms of rampant anti-Semitism, mob rule, all of these things, but that their placement in Atlanta would be deeply threatened.
You'd use non-traditional casting mm-hmm. in this play. Actress Caitlin O'Connell is here. She plays Janice Rothschild in your production, and she obviously enjoys it.
And I love the way that it's been cast, with men and women playing men and women, African-American people playing Jewish people. That's the point of the play, is to try and get you to expand your idea of who you're connected to and who you can truly empathize with, and that we're all just people.
obviously that's non-traditional, because most people say if you want to cast someone as Jewish and you want to not break that fourth wall and keep that illusion of reality in there, you need to cast someone who looks believably Jewish. Why not?
Well, the story is really of not just Atlanta in the civil rights era, but I think our nation at a really crucial moment that I think it is impossible not to hear the language of the play and hear the response of politicians and hear the threat of violence and not think about the now. As well as, I think it's very important to look, I'm focusing on a small contingent of Atlanta in the civil rights era. So it's this German Jewish population. And my way of extrapolating those messages out to greater Atlanta and to greater into the nation and also through eras to now is to really play fast and loose with the casting, because we all understand, I think theater is a place where the audience's imagination is welcomed and warranted. So we understand that the text of the play existed in its historical context, but in the theater we can make leaps of imagination and leaps of association and really bring our own interpretation to it. So by acknowledging that, you know, Ralph McGill spoke these words that were extremely poetic and crucial and won the Pulitzer Prize in response to this bombing from his editorial, A Church, a School. But to have that portrayed by an African-American man, to me, those sentiments are universal and should be extrapolated outside of this one particular bombing to other acts of violence, to other feelings of insecurity, to other minorities across different eras. So that was my attempt.
Ralph McGill was the publisher of, I think it was still just the Atlanta Constitution, mm-hmm. at the time, a well-known journalist and anti-segregation advocate. This type of casting has at least been used in one other very well-known show at this point, and that would be Hamilton, mm-hmm. which has black and brown people in all different colors playing our founding fathers. Do you see this as a change in philosophy for in theater that might grow?
I think that look, Hamilton, because of its success, I think I found very few people questioning that as a theatrical device. I think that it was celebrated and it was very easy for us to look at our founding fathers in this time, this very uncertain time, and relate the ideas of democracy, of immigration, of all of these things that we're grappling with now and then. And to me, the theater is a wonderful place for those conversations to complicate some of the ideas of historical context and the thinking of history as this dry thing that we read about only in the books that can never repeat.
Sadly, means I have to, before we end, I have to ask you a question about current news headlines. Certainly, you probably started writing this play sometime before we saw these recent bomb threats, mm-hmm. at Jewish centers and synagogues. Vandals attacked a Jewish cemetery in Missouri, which is something Nazis used to do, in particular, was to desecrate cemeteries.
Mm-hmm. And just yesterday in Birmingham.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. So we have a huge spike in threats to the Jewish community, which sadly makes your play more relevant maybe than you would want it to be.
Yeah.
Has that changed your attitude toward the material?
It has. Yeah, I've been working on this play for about 14 months, so we were kind of in the midst of the election cycle, but certainly in light of recent events, and not just, you know, looking at the higher levels of power in our country, but really how it's trickled down to what's happening on the ground, it absolutely has made it more relevant, and it has changed the way that I curate the material, how I edit the material, how I feature the material. Again, like I said, I'm not interested in agitprop. I'm not interested in a piece of polemic theater, but really to put forth viewpoints in order to spark conversation. So it has changed how I, you know, feature, for instance, the lead defendant, the perpetrator in the case, George Bright, who I have lots of interview material to work with. It's changed what I put forth and how I kind of curate, orchestrate conversations, but dealing with specific issues of the now.
We only have about a minute left, but I have to ask, do you think that the play is a hopeful story? I mean, we don't seem to learn all that much from history often, but is the play a hopeful story or a tragic one?
It's absolutely a hopeful story. I should also mention it's a very funny story at times, too. Despite its title, The Temple Bombing, there's a lot of levity in it. But yes, no, it's a hopeful story. I think those who know the event know that that everyone in Atlanta rallied with the temple at the time, said, no, not in our city. And the outpouring of support and the alliance between the African-American community and the Jewish community is something that is so strong to this day and in the DNA of churches across the city, but particularly the temple and the way that they've moved forward in affecting social change and making that truly a part of their DNA is absolutely a hopeful message and something that I think we can learn a lot from.
The Temple Bombing premieres Wednesday night at 7:30 at the Alliance Theater. It runs through March 12th. You'll get more details at gpbnews.org. I've been speaking with Jimmy Mays, who is playwright and director of The Temple Bombing. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
When you think of the heroes of fiction, you might think of maybe Superman, Indiana Jones, Princess Leia, strong characters with a lot of confidence, maybe a bit of swagger. But the heroes of Yiddish literature are in general very different from that. Miriam Udell is a professor of Yiddish language, literature, and culture at Emory University, and her new book is called Never Better. It explores the traits, the common traits, of Yiddish protagonists and what that all means. The book recently won the National Jewish Book Award, and Miriam joins me now. Hi there.
Hi. It's
and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Expected
award? Not at all. Not for a first-time author, no.
Did you expect this topic to gain attention?
I hoped that the topic would gain attention among literary scholars, but for the award to come in the category of modern Jewish thought and experience, that really came out of left field and surprised me.
So, but you slogged on. It took you a long time to get this book to the publishers and published. Were there times you were ready to give up on it, or?
I definitely had a sense of despair. You know, the book is about the picaresque, which is a literary form that usually involves many episodes that are either adventures or, more to the point, misadventures.
Like Huckleberry Finn is
like
a typical
Huckleberry
picaresque.
Finn. That's right. That's the American picaresque. And at various points during the publication journey, I felt like not only had I written a book about the picaresque, but it was its own picaresque hero as it had misadventure after misadventure on its way to publication.
What made you focus on it, though? Was it just a matter of reading a number of these novels and realizing how different they were from, than, say, a Huckleberry Finn?
I would say that as I read more and more Yiddish fiction of the 20th century and really tried to figure out what was distinctive about the Jewish experience in Europe and beyond Europe that was being expressed, I realized this doesn't really fit the profile of the other novels that had been very popular coming into the 20th century. Novels about the education and moral formation of a hero who really moves from the margins of society to the city in the center and becomes a full citizen. And I realized that that wasn't the Jewish experience, that there wasn't the kind of geographical mobility and there wasn't the kind of social mobility that would have allowed Jews to become full citizens. And so I needed to figure out what kind of form, literary form, are they using to represent the experience of alienation and marginalization that they were actually having.
Give me an example of a hero that you include in your book that sort of fits this almost anti-heroes because that's not what that means, but in a way, yeah.
Yeah, I call them unheroic heroes.
Right.
And anti-hero is not far off the mark. So I'll tell you about a guy with no name. And I literally mean that the protagonist of this book, with whom we spend a couple of hundred pages, we never find out his name. He is the central figure in a book by Yisrael Rabon. So we know the author's name, but this character is a demobilized soldier. He's a Jew who served in the Polish army, and we meet him just as he's being released from the army, and he's being given a free train ticket to anywhere in Poland that he wants to go, presuming that he's going to go home. But he knows that he has no home to return to. His parents are dead. His father's apartment has been taken over by somebody else. And the guy in front of him in line is an ethnic Pole, and he says that he'll take a ticket to the city of Łódź. And he's so warm and excited and enthusiastic to go to Łódź that our Jewish soldier standing behind him in line says, "All right, I'll also go to Łódź." He has nobody there. And so he just kicks around the city and tries to get warm and tries to get fed and tries to create community for himself, which he does by falling in with a bunch of weirdos. he works at the circus. He befriends this wrestler. He befriends a sad clown. It's just one weirdo after another, a suicidal poet who comes to the circus hall and reads his poems at 2 a.m. so that he can have the feeling of what it would be like to read in a large space. And we never learn the guy's name.
So what? And what book is this?
This book is called The Street.
The Street. Yeah.
Die Gasse in Yiddish. Yeah.
Okay, that's not the only one. If that were the only example of this, then your book would never have won the Jewish Book Award. The thing that is kind of surprising once you start working your way through your book is that that's kind of typical, and it's typical only of Jewish literature, because what else was going on in American literature was really different at the time. These Jewish heroes were often unemployed. They didn't have jobs. They didn't have great educations.
No family in many of these cases.
Certainly no money.
Right.
Why? Were they, I mean, was there a difference? Oftentimes, heroes in literature are aspirational, right?
Absolutely. And these are the characters that you write about when you've stopped aspiring. And in some ways, the insight of the book, the book begins with a sentence saying, "It's a profoundly liberating thing when you stop trying to fix the Jews." And in the 19th century, that is so much of what Jewish literature had been about, trying to either shame the Jews or prod them through laughter into recognizing how pathological and messed up their society was, and helping them to figure out how they could be normal and how they could be better. And we really see this shift at the beginning of the 20th century away from trying to improve the Jews and toward simply describing their lived reality and allowing them to be as wacky and marginal and outsidery as they actually were.
So can we still call them heroes?
I think we can. I mean, in the book, I tend to use the word protagonist more, right? Because we're showing that
this is the
center of literary attention. But there is a kind of wry heroism that emerges from this type that I think finds its way eventually into comedy. That's not the focus of my book, but the picaresque is an essentially comedic form, and it's not immediately the comedy of ha-ha funny. It starts out as this kind of wry, sardonic comedy, but that's how they make their way in the world.
The other thing that struck me was how much of that, what we see in these novels that you're looking at, how much of that we have now absorbed as Americans as being our stereotype of the American Jew, right? My Jewish godparents, my godmother used to tell this joke of how many Jewish grandmothers it'd take to screw in a light bulb. She'd say, "None, I'll sit here in the dock." So, I mean, is that the sort of one of the sources for this image of Jewish humor and culture that we have? Or was it a reflection of a culture that existed?
I think it's both. So what I'm describing in the book is this darker time and this failure of striving and failure of aspiration. And it is real pain. But there is at the same time a sense that while I am living out this pain, I'm also observing my experience. And there's something almost funny about it. And that's why the image that I choose for the cover of the book, if I'm allowed to talk about that on the radio, I always say, please, please judge my book by its cover, because it's the best part of the book. I had nothing to do with actually designing it. I just found the image. But it's an image of several Hasidic Jews wearing their kapotas and their kaftans, pushing an enormous boulder up a hill. And it's an image of futility, of course, but it's also hilarious the way that they are all working together and pushing each other, and one has his hand on the other one's rear end, stabilizing him. And there's a guy sitting at the bottom of the hill observing all of this, and he's sitting on a goat. He's riding this goat with long horns. And the whole thing is just so absurd. It was the perfect visual evocation of the absurdity that a lot of these books are capturing.
Well, and it calls to mind Sisyphus, the king that was forced to roll the boulder up the hill. But in this case, they're all at least helping each other?
That's right. The whole community is working to roll the boulder up the hill. So they are all participants in the same delusion that they're going to be able to do it on the one hand. But as you say, they also form community in the process.
When did it change, if ever? When did the Jewish hero or heroine become more like what we think of when we say hero?
Well, I think that we see the shift toward what my book is about around the turn of the 20th century. And then I think that we see the shift away from what the book is primarily talking about as the Jews emigrate from Europe and reach, on the one hand, the U.S. and on the other hand, Israel. And the epilogue of the book really follows them.
So that would be post-World War II.
Exactly. That's right. And the epilogue of the book really goes to both of those spaces and takes a novel in each case that represents the American Jewish reality and the Israeli Jewish reality and how they end up transcending this kind of curse of the unheroic hero.
So, like, in the 90 seconds that we have left, what did you learn from all of this? What did you learn about your own, about Jewish culture and about history and the Jew as immigrant as opposed to the Scottish immigrant or the African immigrant?
So there's plenty that's distinctive about the Jewish experience that I learned, but I would go meta for a second and say how much I learned that it really takes a community to write a book. And for me, that community was with my collaborator, my husband, Adam Zachary Newton, and many colleagues and many friends. But that it's not an experience for the lonely or for the faint of heart.
Well, that's good enough advice. I'm speaking with Miriam Udell, professor of Yiddish language, literature, and culture at Emory University. Her new book is called Never Better. It recently won the National Jewish Book Award. Thank you so much, and congratulations again.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be with you, Celeste.
Cars may get smarter and more sophisticated all the time, but the roads they drive on are still pretty much just pavement. But that's starting to change as states like Georgia turn highways into technology laboratories. GPB's Bradley George reports that states are shifting the role of highways from managing traffic to sustaining the environment.
Allie Kelly sits on a concrete bench outside a rest area along I-85 in western Georgia near the Alabama state line as cars and trucks whoosh by at 70 miles an hour.
The road is still dumb.
Kelly works for the RAE, a nonprofit that's a key funding priority for the Ray C. Anderson Foundation, which funds environmental projects. It spent about $500,000 to make this highway smarter. Some of that money has gone to test solar panels in a roadside rest stop and a system for drivers to check tire pressure without leaving their cars. And there are plans for drones and sensors to monitor traffic and roadside channels filled with plants that will purify storm runoff.
We want to demonstrate to the world that transportation can go zero carbon. We also want to prove to the world that we can go zero deaths. We want to become more efficient. We want to unlock value in our system of roads and system of right-of-way.
Later this year, the foundation will install a solar farm in the median and shoulders of the interstate.
Part of our partnership is to learn and to try and to innovate such that we can deploy this outside of this corridor on Interstate 85 and potentially to the rest of the state and hopefully to the nation as well.
Russell McMurray is commissioner of the Georgia Department of Transportation. While the Anderson Foundation comes up with ideas for the I-85 project, his agency provides technical expertise.
We have our normal day jobs to do, and you know, we don't have just, extra staff sitting around saying, what if? But it's a challenge. You know, it's having them to help challenge us to be innovative and think about things differently.
Other states are starting similar initiatives. Missouri wants to turn Interstate 70 into what it calls a road to tomorrow, which would use some of the same technologies in the Georgia project. Ohio, Utah, and Virginia are embedding sensors that can communicate with vehicles about traffic and road conditions. Bob Skinner is the former chairman of the Transportation Research Board, a program of the National Academy of Sciences. He says states and engineers have always looked for ways to improve roads, but that effort is starting to accelerate in anticipation of the day drivers will share the road with driverless cars.
We're going to have a whole host of operational questions about operating highways with both autonomous vehicles and non-autonomous vehicles. What sort of delineation, roadside markers, stripes on the side of roads and so forth, what sort of features will aid the vehicles in self-navigation?
California is already taking steps to prepare for driverless vehicles. The state is also looking for ways to make road construction greener. Kome Ejise of the California Department of Transportation says his agency wants to use more environmentally friendly materials, such as concrete made with reclaimed ash from coal power plants. But many contractors are reluctant.
There are implications for a larger market because contractors that work in our market also work in other states. And so we're making sure that we're not doing something that puts them at a disadvantage.
All of this is happening as state governments try to figure out how to pay for their current road needs. Many have raised gas taxes. For GPB News, I'm Bradley George in Atlanta.
And that's our show for today, but we always welcome your thoughts. Do you think about the environment when you make big purchases like a car or a house? Does it matter how environmental the construction was? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on Twitter or Facebook. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.